First, I want to say that I'm a product of the public schools of New York City, and I went to the public schools back in 1930. I entered the first grade in 1931. At that time, the public schools were still doing what you would call a decent job. As a matter of fact, at our assemblies, the principal would read something from the Bible, usually a psalm, and I remember the 23rd psalm very, very vividly. As a matter of fact, that I got a good deal of religion out of that. You know, now, having been brought up in a Jewish family where religion is conveyed in Hebrew, which I couldn't understand, you know, or in family ceremonies, you know, the Sabbath candles and kosher home and all of that, I was very grateful that I could hear the Bible read in English by a principal. So it had a considerable influence on me. Well, of course, that's no longer permissible. But in those days, they also taught reading, writing, and arithmetic in the traditional manner. And so I learned to read very nicely, and I remember my teachers with a great deal of affection and respect. In those days, the teacher was in front of the room, the kids were behind him in desks that were bolted to the floor. You know, so you didn't have this constant shifting and moving every morning, you know, the furniture being rearranged. And we learned history, we learned subject matter. We didn't learn this mishmash called social studies. We learned history. We learned geography. We actually learned geography. And the first lessons we learned were about New York City, that it was divided up into five boroughs, and we studied the whole city, the history of the city and all that. It was fascinating to learn all of this. The other day when I was in North Carolina talking to a youngster who had gone to a Christian school, he's 15, been in a Christian school from day one, very poor reader, and I wanted to find out if he knew any geography. I asked him, I said, can you name a country in Africa? No, in South America. Can you name a country in South America? Couldn't think of one. I said, there's a country there that starts with B. Couldn't think of it. Then I asked him, I said, well, can you name a country in Europe? And he looked at me, he said, London? I said, London is not a country, it's a city. Can you tell me what country London is located in? He said, France? I said, London is the capital of England. Whatever gave you the idea that London was in France? He said, well, we had a French teacher who often went to London. So I assumed that London was in France. I said, here's a youngster who was in a Christian school since the age of 6, and he's 15. They don't teach geography, not even in a Christian school. And I knew these things as a 10-year-old. I mean, I used to, you know, pore over maps. What's happened? And of course, it's the same in every subject. So the risks are really four risks. There's the academic risk, there's the spiritual risk, the moral risk, and the physical risk. I showed you some of the physical risk this morning. The newspapers, what's happening in the public schools these days, they're not safe places. So don't assume that you're putting your child in a safe place if you put them in a public school. It's a very risky place. There are schools now where they have metal detectors and where they've got to check weapons checks. The number of children who are now going to school with weapons for self-protection has increased manyfold. Why? Because this is a godless institution where the children are unrestrained in their behavior. And your classmate would just as well kill you as look at you. You see, that's what's happened. So the risks are very great physically. The academic risks I spoke about last night, and I will go over them again this morning. You had, first of all, the way they teach, the methodology, the way they teach reading, The methods are calculated to produce reading failure, dyslexia, learning disabilities. Back in the 70s, I wrote a book entitled The New Illiterates. I wrote that book because I wanted to bring the Rudolf Flesch's story up to date. You know, Rudolf Flesch wrote his book in 1955, Why Johnny Can't Read. And in that book, he explained why the children weren't learning to read. He said, they're not learning to read because they're not teaching them to read in the proper manner. And he explained how in the early 1930s, the professors of education changed the way readings taught in the schools. They threw out the alphabetic phonics method, which is the proper way to teach children to read an alphabetic writing system, and they put in this new look, say, whole word, or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese. And he said, that's the reason why the children aren't learning, because when you impose an ideographic teaching system on an alphabetic writing system, you get reading disability. Now, when I found that out, and then started substitute teaching in the schools of Quincy, Massachusetts, high schools and the junior high schools, I was amazed at the poor reading ability of the students. See, I had been brought up in an immigrant family. I knew what illiteracy was like. My mother was illiterate. And so I had lived with illiteracy. I knew what it was like. And I said to myself, hey, these kids read as if they just got off the boat. What is it? They're born in this country, they're being educated in this country, and they stumble and fumble, you know, and have all these problems of reading. I said, something terribly wrong. And this was 1970. I said, well, Rudolf Flesch's book came out in 1955. How come things haven't improved any? I said, something is terribly wrong somewhere. Well, the reason why they weren't improved is because the educators had no intention of changing anything or going back to alphabetic phonics. As a matter of fact, they created the International Reading Association, which became the professional stronghold, the professional citadel of the look-say method, of the ideographic method, and the headquarters of the International Reading Association is down the road in Newark, Delaware. Here it is, right in your own state. The source of the evil is right there. In any case, I realized that things were not getting any better, so I thought I'd better bring this situation up to date. So I wrote The New Illiterates, and in writing that book, I did a line-by-line study analysis of the Dick and Jane reading program. And I'm sure most of you were taught by Dick and Jane. You know, see, spot, run, jump, 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 look, look, look. You all knew it was stupid when you were being taught it. I mean, the kids are much smarter than that, you know. But the parents tell the kids, well, listen to the teacher, do what the teacher tells you. So they sit there, look, 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 run, run, run. You know, and as a matter of fact, that's where so much of this rock music, which is so repetitive, I think comes from, that training of constantly repeating these stupid words, you know. In any case, I did a line-by-line analysis, and I came to the conclusion that anyone taught to read by this method, anyone taught exclusively by this method, would exhibit the symptoms of dyslexia. So if I could find that out, and I was not a professor of education, I was just a simple, intelligent human being who just figured it out. I said, don't they know this? Well, I found out that they had been told this back in 1929 by Dr. Samuel T. Orton, who had made a study of children with reading disabilities and came to the conclusion that their disabilities had been caused by this new teaching method. And he told it to the educators in 1929. And a year later, in 1930, the Dick and Jane books were published. And the Macmillan readers, produced by Arthur Gates of Columbia University, Teachers College, Columbia University, were published. Now, it's very interesting that this whole word method, which had been You might say inspired, not inspired. He didn't invent the whole word method. It was I did a little historical survey and found out that the method had actually been invented by a minister, by the Reverend Thomas Gallaudet. Thomas H. Gallaudet, the teacher of the deaf and dumb in Hartford, Connecticut, in the early 1800s. Now, if you're teaching the deaf to read and the deaf can't hear, you know, it's difficult to teach them phonetically. So he used pictures and words and juxtaposed them and taught them sight vocabulary, so to speak. And he thought to himself, well, maybe normal kids could learn the same way. And so we could avoid this problem of the drill, you know, with the baby by Bobu and the ab-ab-ab-ab stuff. And, you know, we'll make it easier for them by showing them pictures and words, and they'll learn to read. Well, so the method was approved by the Boston primary schools that had become government schools. You see, prior to that, the primary schools were not government schools. They were private. Prior to that, a child had to know how to read and write before they could go to school. But when the government took over the primary schools, then they started messing around with reading and writing. And so they adopted Gallaudet's Prima, and it was used in the Boston schools for about 8 years when the schoolmasters in the upper grades realized what was happening. These kids were coming to the upper grades unable to read. And so they exploded in a critique of this new method. And so the first critique of the whole word method was actually written in 1844 by the Boston schoolmasters. And I reproduced it in my book, The New Illiterates, because I wanted parents to understand how far back this problem goes and how it was already known in 1844 that this methodology did not work. Well, they resuscitated it, the progressives did, and put it in the schools basically throughout the American school system in the 1930s. But prior to that, John Dewey and his progressive pals were able to persuade Lenin's wife, Krupskaya, to adopt the progressive program in the new Soviet schools. And they did. And of course, as you know, Lenin died in 1924. The methods were in the schools. And in 1932, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union made an abrupt about-face. They said, we got to get rid of this method. We want to train scientists. We want technicians. We want engineers who are going to build the most efficient war machine in the world, and we're not going to get it with these idiots, with these functional illiterates. So they threw it out, and they went back to intensive systematic phonics. And that is why the Russians have probably the highest rate of literacy of any nation in the world today. There is no dyslexia in the Soviet Union. No functional illiteracy. They all learned to read very well. And also they reinstituted the teaching of separate subject matter. Of course, that was their final undoing, because they taught that people how to read. And once you give them that ability, that power, even though you restrict what they're going to read, you make it difficult for them to get the right books. Nevertheless, it's awfully hard to prevent a reading public from getting ideas that are going to undermine the system. And so eventually they did undermine. High literacy undermined the socialist communist system. Now, here were American educators who knew that the project had failed in the Soviet Union. They knew that the experiment had been a total failure. And yet they adopted it for use in the United States. That did not change their minds. They knew it had failed in 1844. They knew that Dr. Orton said it produced learning disabilities, produced dyslexia. And they knew that it had been a total failure in the Soviet Union, and yet they proceeded to put it in American schools. And in 1955, when Dr. Rudolf Flesch's book came out and woke up the parents of America, What did they do? They got together and created the International Reading Association, which now has its headquarters, as I said, in Newark. And that reading association, that professional organization, has ridden herd on the teachers of America to make sure that they do not deviate from the planned dumbing down of the American people. And so that has gone on now uninterruptedly since the early 1930s, to the point now where our newspapers are written at a sixth grade level. You pick up any bestseller today and you'll see that it's written in short sentences. You know, he said, she said. Not much of a vocabulary. An occasional three-syllable word. But that's the extent to which the American people have been dumbed down. I don't think that we're aware of the effects that this has had throughout our society and why now people are so dependent on television, why newspapers are going out of business. If people, as a matter, but you know, it's interesting. I've spent the last 20 years or so doing a lot of work with the functionally illiterate. Because after I wrote my book, The New Illiterates, I realized that it was one thing to criticize what was being done. It was one thing to show what was wrong. But I had to provide parents with a means of redressing the situation for doing it at home. And so I wrote How to Tutor, in which I told parents how to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic in the traditional manner, very simple. And also I produced the Alpha Phonics book as a result of my tutoring of these youngsters. Now, how does your typical functionally illiterate youngster read? Well, you find out that they can read along at a nice clip, but then you notice as they're reading it, they leave out words that are there. They put in words that aren't there. They misread words. They skip words. They mutilate words. They truncate words. You'll see a word like newspaper. It says newspaper, but they say paper. The word says telephone, they say phone. In other words, they're not reading what is there. They're looking at little pictures. Each word represents a picture to them. Now, how many words can you remember as pictures? Not very many. So that's why the reading ability is so limited in America. And that's why we have this shrinking vocabulary. Throughout the United States, we have a shrinking vocabulary. Big words are not used. They're discouraged. As a matter of fact, if you work for a newspaper and you start using big words, your editor is going to start crossing them out. Any of the mass media newspapers, perhaps the Wall Street Journal is the only newspaper in the country that still uses a pretty decent vocabulary, an extensive vocabulary where they give the writers the freedom to use words that they want, and maybe you can find them in Bill Buckley's column, you know. But that's for the elite, you know, the few truly highly literate people. I remember once reading something that Truman Capote, the writer, said, who used to lecture at many of the universities. He said that only 20% of the students were literate. 20%. At the university level, he was talking. 20% were literate. So if you put your child in a public school, there's a 30% chance that that child will be severely learning disabled. Severely. And to give you an idea of how painful that can be, I tutored a Boston businessman in his 40s, highly successful in real estate, one of Boston's most successful restaurateurs, graduate of Indiana University, who told me he couldn't read. But what he meant by that every third or fourth word was a mystery to him, and so he considered himself to be illiterate. And so when I started tutoring him, he told me he asked me, is this phonics? I said, yes. He said, well, you know, when I was in the first grade, our class was divided up into two parts. One part had phonics, and the other part had something else. He said, I had the something else. But he then told me something that was really stuck in my mind, and I will never forget. He told me that he would rather be beaten than have to read. rather be beaten than have to read, but shows you how much psychic pain is involved in that method. Now, a method that creates such psychic pain and is still being used today so extensively in the country had to be invented by some diabolical individuals. It's not the kind of thing that anyone can just accidentally do. As a matter of fact, the production of functional illiteracy today is a science. You need specially trained teachers, special textbooks, special reading programs. It's not easy producing functional literacy. And then how do you keep someone in school for 12 years and make sure that he or she doesn't learn to read? It's not easy. You know what you do? You pretend to teach. And the kids pretend to learn. And the parents worry over their child who has a learning disability or dyslexia or attention deficit disorder. That's the latest. Now, why do the kids have attention deficit disorder? Well, look at it this way. These methods, which were devised and created by the world's leading psychologists, are the equivalent of a non-surgical prefrontal lobotomy. Now, if you were having your brain operated on, would you sit still in a class? Why do you think the kids can't sit still, don't want to sit still? Because they know that something is being done to that very intelligent brain of theirs. And so they squirm and they want to defend themselves. This is a defensive mechanism of trying to turn off what the teacher is telling them, because what the teacher is doing is creating such abrasion, such gear. You know what happens when your gears don't mesh? Do you ever hear it in your car? If you got the motor running and you turn on the ignition and you hear that noise where the gears are stripping one another? That's what's happening, you see. They're using methods that are calculated to destroy the logical processes of the brain. And no child should sit still while that's taking place. But so now they call it, when the kids act up, they call it attention deficit disorder. And of course the psychologists have a solution for that problem, don't they? They drug the little monsters. Ritalin. And Ritalin is used today in schools like aspirin, you know. Parents are told, oh, your child needs Ritalin. And so what do the parents know? Parents believe the teachers, they trust the teachers, they trust the school, and they don't realize that their child is being turned into a permanently crippled, mentally crippled individual. Permanent. Unless they get some kind of help from somebody who knows something. Like this father in North Carolina calls me out of the blue. He said, Dr. Blumenfeld, I heard you speak at the North Carolina Homeschool Association some years ago, and you said that dyslexia was artificially induced. He said, my son is dyslexic. Can you help him? I said, well, I don't know. I haven't met him. I'd have to know more about him. So he was willing to have me come all the way down to North Carolina and spend a week at his home to see what I could do with his son. Well, I found out. I went down there, and there was nothing wrong with the boy. He wasn't brain damaged. Perfectly normal youngster who had been... This was in a Christian school. He had been made that way by a first grade teacher who didn't know any better. But he had gotten all the way up to the eighth grade and was afflicted with this reading problem. And so I gave him intensive. There are ways that you can overcome this. What you have to do is try to change a sight reader into a phonetic reader. And it takes very special techniques, but it can be done. And so we spent a week at it. He was able to get leave from school for a week. And we just went at it, you know, from morning till evening. And he's come out of it. it came out of it, you see. But it took an awful lot of work to do. Now, how many fathers can do that? How many fathers can... Certainly, that father knew about me because he had met me, you see. But how many people in America can do that for any set of parents? But we were able to change that youngster into a phonetic reader. Now, a friend of mine, Edward Miller, in North Carolina, has been doing a lot of very interesting research. His grandson was dyslexic before he went to school, and he was wondering, how could this possibly happen? Perfectly normal. Why would this youngster be dyslexic before he got to school, before the teachers had had a chance to do anything? He made a very interesting discovery. He discovered that there are a lot of kids who in the preschool years memorized the Dr. Seuss books. And they learned these words as wholes, configurations. And so we did a little research on Dr. Seuss, and I found out that Dr. Seuss, when he wrote his books, did not choose his own words. He was given 220 sight words by the publishing company and told to write his stories using these words. And he writes about how he struggles to try to make a story out of these stupid words. But finally he said the first two words that rhymed, he said, that's it, the cat in the hat. And so he wrote the story, The Cat in the Hat, based on that. Now, why did the publishing company choose these words, these 200 words? Because those are the words that were going to be taught in the first grade, you see. So if the child had memorized those words as a child at home before he got to school, so when he got to school and were given these same sight words, he'd be able to read, and then the teachers would say, see what a wonderful job we're doing, your child can read. And the parents would say, oh, well, how wonderful, he can read all these wonderful little stories, you see, but they were all the same sight words. By the time the child got to the third grade, of course, forget it. I mean, then the child couldn't handle all the new words. And if they tried to teach phonics, since this boy was being put in a Christian school where they taught some phonics, you see, when you develop this sight vocabulary and start to read in that manner, you develop a blockage against looking at those words phonetically. That's dyslexia that's caused by preschool memorization of a sight vocabulary. Memorization of the Dick and Jane books. So there was the answer, because I had been asked that question. Well, Dr. Blumenfeld, if you say that the schools cause dyslexia, how come my child was dyslexic before he got to school? Well, that's the answer. That child had memorized the Dr. Seuss books. And even Dr. Seuss knew that there was something wrong with this, because he said, he even admitted, he believed that the reason why the kids were having these reading problems was because they were departing from phonics and going into sight. But he made a couple of $1 million by simply writing these stories that the publishers wanted. But it has created great harm. Now, a child can read the Dr. Seuss books in the proper manner, provided he's taught the letters and the sounds, you see. So if you're giving your child these books to memorize, don't do that. If you have preschool children, teach them how to read before you give them a book to read. Teach them how to read first before you give them a book to read. Otherwise, they're going to memorize the books. Edward Miller devised a very simple test to determine whether a child was a sight reader or a phonetic reader. What he did was, the first section of the test consists of the words from The Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham, the two most popular of the Seuss books. And the second part of the test consists of simple, single-syllable, regular, phonetically regular words taken from Dr. Flesch's lists in the back of his book, Why Johnny Can't Read. Well, the typical sight reader will go through the sight words, no problem, rapidly, very few mistakes. But then when he gets to this other list, equally simple, one syllable, phonetically regular words, they will have terrible problems, and the number of errors increase, the rate of reading slows down, so you can clearly see, dramatically see the difference between the sight reader and the phonetic reader. And it's such a dramatic and clear, demonstration of the two ways of reading. A phonetic reader can never become a sight reader. A phonetic reader can never become dyslexic, but a sight reader, if he does not overcome those blockages, will be dyslexic for the rest of his life. And Edward Miller went to the local public school and tested the children there and found that 40% of the children were already in the second grade dyslexic. 40%. 40%. And that's mandated in the schools of North Carolina. And I would say that's mandated throughout the United States. So if you see that rate of functional illiteracy being created by the public schools now, what are these kids going to be doing 20 years from now? Who's going to remediate them? Who's going to help them? They're going to become the underclass of tomorrow. Or what they will be are these middle class people who have very poor reading ability who somehow try to overcome their disability, their handicap. Now, Edward Miller's been trying to get the State Department of Education to get back to intensive phonics. And I can tell you, it's hitting your head against a stone wall. He tried to get a grant from the U.S. government. Forget it. He showed me the letters. I mean, I've been on the phone with him for hours, and he's telling me the travails that he's gone through trying to get through to these people. These people don't want to know, or they do know. They know that intensive phonics works, but they are committed to the notion that dyslexia is genetically caused, that there's something wrong with the children. You see, they're committed to that because there's big federal dollars in that. These people are getting million-dollar grants to do research in the genetic causes of dyslexia. Well, who's going to give that up? You can see what's happened. So the education system has gone down the tubes as far as education is concerned. They don't know how to teach reading. Writing, I mentioned last night that they do everything backwards. They teach printing before they teach cursive. Now, why should you teach cursive first? Well, first of all, if they're going to teach writing, you might as well teach the kids to write. Now, I was taught cursive first. I wasn't even taught printing at all. I had to learn to print later on in art class or when I was doing drafting in high school. That's when I learned to print. But I was taught cursive from the first grade. Now, why should you teach cursive first? Because it's easier. Not only is it easier, it's more natural for the children, because the children like to do things in circles and swirls and things like that. They're not going to do perfect balls and perfect sticks, you know. Ball and stick. You've heard of ball and stick? That's the kind of print script that the children are taught to. They call it manuscript. The problem with ball and stick is that so many of these letters look alike that the children tend to confuse them. The B's and the D's, the T's and the F's, the G's and the P's and the Q's all look alike. But if you teach a child to write cursive, it helps them learn to read print. Why? Because in cursive, the letters are quite different. A B, you know how you write a B in cursive? You start like an L, right? You go up. And how do you write a D? Like an A. You start like an A. Very different. Now, you see, that knowledge in the hand is connected to the knowledge in the brain and the knowledge of the eyes. And they all work together. Because parents often ask me, well, aren't you going to confuse the child by teaching them cursive and to read print at the same time? No. They are not confused. As a matter of fact, they are helped. Another reason why they are helped is because in cursive, all the letters are connected, so they see the whole word as a connected series of letters. And the letters have to be written in a particular manner so that this letter will join with the next letter. In other words, you can't do it backwards. Print, you can print any way you want, and there are kids who print backwards. You know, they'll do the letters backwards. And they'll put all sorts of space between the letters. So you don't know where one word ends and the next one begins, do you? But in cursive, that problem is solved. They know where the word is. They know how the letters are connected. They know the proper sequence. And that knowledge of the hand is put into the brain. The hand develops knowledge, and any touch typist knows it. Anyone who is a touch typist knows that when they make an error, they know it. Because it's the sequence of muscular movements that become apparent. That's the same with writing. Now, a person who learns to write cursive first can always learn to print very well later on. But a child who learns print first may never develop a good cursive. Why? Well, if you hold the pen this way and print straight up and down, first of all, you're using much more pressure, much more energy. You're concentrating on straight lines and perfect little circles, you see. And you're holding the paper this way. And then you're telling the child then to go into cursive. Well, if you're spending 2 years writing that way, your hand has developed its own sense, its own knowledge of how to do things. You're not going to retrain. You're going to tell the child to unlearn that? To unlearn that and to become a cursive writer where you have to relax and hold your hand at the side and tilt the paper and write in totally different manner? So what happens? Generally, kids will develop a hybrid, part print, part cursive. Some will develop a decent cursive, but many kids will just print for the rest of their lives. They'll print for the rest of their lives, they develop a hybrid, and some do develop a decent cursive. But generally, those are the kids who are willing to put in the time, because in the third grade, the kids are so busy doing other things, learning about apartheid in South Africa, or they don't have time to develop a good cursive. And it takes time. It's a skill. And when is the best time to teach a skill? In the first grade, where they have the time, and they can develop it, and once they develop it, they have it. Now, of course, our Christian schools are still teaching the children to print, most of them. There are not too many Christian schools that teach the children cursive first, because it's now so ingrained in the educators that they've got to go through this three-step business of print script, then slant print script, or precursive, and then cursive. What a waste. Somebody asked me, should I teach precursive? I said, precursive? What's precursive? Teach cursive, period, I mean, teach them one way to write. Some parents say, well, I'm teaching my child italic. Well, I asked them, I said, do you expect your child to write Christmas cards for the rest of his life? I mean, teach a standard cursive that's easy and can be used for the rest of his or her life. And it becomes your standard writing, because children will only learn one way to write. They don't have the time nor the inclination to learn three ways. They're all going to learn one way. And it's a skill that's a hand skill that requires practice, and those little hands at that early age should be taught correctly. They should be taught to hold the pen correctly, which schools no longer do. First of all, the teachers don't care how the kids hold the pen. They don't care how they spell. They call it invented spelling. You've heard of invented spelling? Yeah. Kiddies, write it in any way you like, and hold the pen any way you like. So you get them with the stab hold, the muscular dystrophy hold. I mean, you've got kids who use four fingers, five fingers. It's ridiculous. There was this youngster the other day, four fingers. I said, why are you holding it with four fingers? I said, it only takes three fingers. I said, if you hold it with four fingers, you're going to develop a cramp. You will not be able to write for very long because you will feel a cramp. And I told him, I said, I can write for hours and not to tire at all. And I tell parents, I say, do you believe that you should teach your children to write? They all agree that children should be taught to write, even though they've been told by their educators that writing is passé. Now we have typewriters and computers. Nobody has to write anymore. But I said, can you predict what your child is going to be doing 20 years from now? No. Your child may be in the publishing business, may be a writer, and is stranded somewhere with just a paper and pencil, and doesn't have an electric outlet, or a typewriter, or a computer. You mean that child's going to be handicapped, unable to write? Well, everybody agrees that the child should be taught to write. Well, if you're going to teach children to write, teach them cursive. That's the best thing that you can do for them. And make sure that you teach them how to hold the pen correctly, because if they develop a habit, a four-finger habit, forget it. It's impossible to break these habits. That's what I have found. Maybe with some effort at it, but it's impossible. How are we doing?
About 3 more minutes.
3 more minutes? I just started. Well, I can tell you, I can go on for another hour about arithmetic, but let me just say that they're not teaching arithmetic. You know, memorization is out. The spiritual risk is obvious. They're training your child to be pagans. They're training the American children to be pagans. So religion is out, God is out, and they're using all sorts of techniques to do that. Evolution, values clarification, multiculturalism, you name it. They're destroying the religious beliefs of the youngsters. The moral, I don't have to tell you about the moral risk. Schools that are giving out condoms to children, I mean, can you believe it? Can you have confidence in such people? I mean, you look at them, the perversity of it all, the depravity of it all is so obvious. For schools to actually give youngsters condoms at a time when there's this deadly disease, I mean, what kind of people are they? For anyone to put their children in the hands of those depraved monsterettes, you know, forget it. Forget it. And I've told them about the physical dangers. So there you are. Those are the risks. And that's why I tell parents today, under no circumstances put a child in a government school. No circumstances. Under no circumstances. Well, some people, you know, I always get this, well, our school is different. We have such wonderful teachers. She's a Christian. But, you know, I'll tell you the story of a little boy in Michigan. A 9-year-old in the second grade. This teacher, this veteran teacher, she was not a youngster out of some college, she was a veteran 60-year-old teacher, decided to show these 9-year-olds a film about suicide. Did she ask parents' permission? Of course not. So this little boy watched this film about suicide, and then the next day he imitated what he saw in the film and hung himself. Now, his mother has told me that her little boy was not suicidal. He was simply imitating what he saw in the film. And the mother and the family, they've gone to court. And how do you think the judge has ruled? Did he rule in favor of the parents? Did he hold the schools responsible for this? Of course not. He said the schools have the freedom of speech. They were protected by the Freedom of Speech Amendment, you know, to do anything they want to the kids, and the parents have no recourse. So you don't know when it's going to hit. You don't know what they're going to do. You don't know what can happen to a child. So that's why I tell parents, under no circumstances, put your child in today's government schools. They're finished. It's over. They can't be improved. They're going to even go further downhill with outcome-based education, with whole language, with all of that stuff. It's going to become so much worse that you're going to see an exodus from the public schools that we haven't seen yet. And the homeschool movement attests to that. So I want to encourage you to take your children's education into your own hands. Give them the godly education that they deserve and that they need. Thank you very much.